versus Senator Bassett. Mr. Bates. Mr. Gansa.
Because the monster killed the saint.
Because the monster killed the saint, yes. That, we submit, is the basis on which the common friend is found to be
birth. It seems to me that almost any time the judge represents that. Thank you.
But then the Court of Appeals made their independent review. And what were the mitigating factors in this case?
The mitigating factors are trumpet also.
Mitigating factors that the court should have found in this particular case?
Well, we would submit that Mr. Bassett has the qualities that he would have came forward.
Yeah, I'd like to
know. He's somebody who's rather demonstrating somebody who, in fact, has charm in many contexts. Has charm.
Now, how would that, where would that fall under the
and there was also an effort, there was a substantial effort, unsuccessful, to send a time to say, was it recognized? It was not going to go out of one. It's our position, however, we all emphasize that the failure of the Court of Appeals was not in the weighing that it conducted, but in the fact that it conducted the weighing in the first place. That given the specifics of what they found wrong, or what we believe was wrong, in the trial court, we should never have gotten to an independent claim. Because what you have is a case where the panel itself demonstrated, and what the court essentially recognized, demonstrated that its decision was based on passion, on bias, on the very things that we elect to try to take to a panel in order to avoid to a jury. That having done that, having made that recognition, it follows, and the Court of Appeals should have recognized, that there is that Mr. Bassett has no impartial arbiter. That he was not in front of a tribunal, serving his proper tribunal function to coldly look at the evidence, to conduct the balancing and weighing. In national fashion, had he not had that, he denied the fundamental of what our system is about. We had structurally unfair mitigation hearing.
I want to pursue that because you've argued that in your brief that our independent review of the record, which we're required to do, cannot cure the defect here in the trial court judgment. I interrupted you. Maybe you were going to talk more about that. I'd like to hear your strongest argument on that. Why cannot our independent review cure that defect?
It's a two-part review. Part one is that you shouldn't be getting to that stage. Legal issues come first. The procedure that's set up and the way it works is you get to the independent review upon affirming everything else gone wrong. Now, we submit that the mitigation hearing was so unfair to the outcome on it can't be supported. And therefore, that alone requires the court that we don't get to the independent review. The second part of the answer is that the trial court failed in what I like to think of as gatekeeping function. The court's job in this case, the panel's job, the jury's job for a jury case, is to serve as a gatekeeper to death row, deciding when that door will open and somebody will pass through, and when the door will stay closed and somebody will go off the floor. In those days, 20 years ago, or 30 years ago. The gatekeeping function wasn't served here because that's required to be served by an impartial order. When you don't have that, you don't have the original decision having been made that further review can follow from. It's not a case where what we have is, hey, you know, you hold too much weight to this, that, to this, that, maybe there is not enough to that mitigating factor, and maybe they considered something that they weren't quite supposed to consider in aggravating circumstance. That's not what we have here. What we have here is something else relates to this for the constitution at another time. Because of the presumption set forth in Postman that a panel will properly review matters, will properly apply law, will make its decision on the basis of those things on which it is supposed to make its decision that overdoes. Now, in this case, to some extent, the Court of Appeals said, no, that presumption doesn't apply. Once they can't buy that here, they didn't do it. They affirmatively showed they didn't do it. So the presumption sits there, and a defendant way of the jury sets himself up for that presumption and loses as a practical matter, or potentially loses as a practical matter, the right to break the kind of prohibition. We submit that we have a constitutional, a fundamental constitutional right to the jury. That waiver must be, as this court said back in 1978 in Gruber, made with sufficient awareness of the relevant circumstances and likely consequences of a waiver. In this case, we submit, as in Gruber, although by implication here, rather than put so directly, the Sebastian was misled by the court into believing that he was given a complete list of those things which he was giving up by not having a jury. He was not told about the assumption. He was not told this. And with under those circumstances, the jury waiver cannot be knowing intelligent and voluntary. You don't know if that would likely consequences of what it is you're giving up.
The Passion and Prejudice you make reference to, the victim impact statement, principally?
Certainly that is central to it. It also comes through in things like description of this against the habit of violence. The purposeful nature, the vicious, cowardly circumstances of becoming a child law far override the soul of mitigating factors in the mind. And this is the language of.
Are you going to get to the victim impact statement?
It comes out of their deep abiding and understanding.
Mammy, are you going to discuss that with us in any detail?
The nature of the victim impact? Well, I would say that as a town looking at one of us, you see, asserted on the record that they read those books before the mitigation day. Mitigation began with relatives of the victim getting out and discussing what a fine gentleman he was, what a good character he was. There was a basis. There are questions. There was a basis that the court on which it didn't come out of nowhere. The suggestion is not that it came directly from material that was intended to be
used. Now, let's start with the law on the issue in the procedure. This did not happen in the trial phase, did it?
In the guilt phase,
all right. Now we're to the mitigation phase. What proscription is there against this type of material in the mitigation phase? In the mitigation phase, right? Okay.
What happens in this case is not, and our objection is not to the presence of the evidence in support of counsel.
It is to what?
It is to what the panel did with the evidence that they received. And the point behind victim impact evidence, the reason we've been wary of all these decades until recently, is obviously the change that we allow it in mitigation. The reason that we have always been so wary of this is intended to generate what we believe is the kind of kind of emotional response that generates in this case. It is the danger of being to make that difference. It is not the danger of false action. It is
Are you bottoming your claim of error that the three-judge panel and the fact that the three-judge panel used the colorful rhetoric that the panel used in its opinion, and therefore that's the error? Because the real issue is, not did they use that, not did they consider it, but did they use it in the weighing? And I can't find in their opinion where they said, because he was the kind of person he was in the community, that is the decedent, and because his family testified, and because Batson was such a hideous person, therefore we weigh all those and find that aggravation exceeds mitigation and he gets the death penalty. They didn't say that, did they? So we have to assume, do we not, that they, as Justice Pfeiffer was indicating, maybe were exposing their human side and element, but we also have to assume, because it's not in the opinion, that they didn't use that in their weighing. As to one of the mitigating circumstances. It wasn't the little weight.
That was a significant factor.
Yeah, okay.
For the field recognizes that there's not even a significant factor, it's not a significant factor at all. So at least it does have some role. The problem we have is this. But here's the point.
Before we get to the two propositions that he discussed and you want to discuss, I got the flavor from the Court of Appeals, from the trial court's opinion, the three-judge panel, that they had a feeling that in addition to him being the principal offender, there was prior calculation and design. Is that solely based on his entry into the shop some 18 days before? What else would it have been based on? Because it seems to me they say, we don't consider that because it's not necessary here. And then I read the next paragraph and they seem to consider it. Extraneous to this opinion, they say. But they mention it. Need prior calculation design, but along with some of the other colorful language they use, they put that in, even though they say we're not relying on it, and it makes you read it pretty carefully to see whether or not what they have considered that maybe they shouldn't have. For instance, let's go to the weighing question. They say, in part, regardless, this panel unanimously finds beyond a reasonable doubt and beyond any residual doubt that the purposeful nature and the vicious, cowardly circumstances of defendant's killing of Chong Ma far override the sole mitigating factor. Does that embellish the aggravating specification some? It seems so. Pardon me? Okay. Well, then, if it's bad drafting, if it exceeds what we know the statute says with regard to the weighing, is it reversible error? There really is all five that you need to fall back on in this case, or at least helps our independent review. Go further with it. Counsel for the defendant and for the state of Ohio made reference in closing arguments to their personal views on capital punishment. And then this, counselor. Others have speculated outside the courtroom as to the personal views of the individual members of this panel. But of course, they have no bearing on the analytical process. But they're there, aren't they? Does that also answer why they would say prior to trial and between trial and mitigation, this panel received a number of written communications from friends and family of both the defendant and the victim. These letters marked as court's exhibits were not formally offered in mitigation. We know they're not as part of the record, nor as victim impact statements. They have played no role in the outcome of this case, but they mention it. About victim impact letters, it probably is. Well, is that proper?
Does appear that, I mean, just reading what we can say whatever you want about, well, gratuitous and thrown in there, but we've got to do, that's their thinking. That tells us what they're thinking, the process they're using. And so what about that issue? What do we do with that?
Difference to you if you found out after a verdict that the jury had received letters from friends concerning the victim and that they had read them during their deliberation? Would that cause any problem with you?
Sure.
Huh? Oh, wait a minute. Then how can you distinguish between the letters that the judges received and read as serving as a jury and say, well, they said they ignored them and so we must believe them? But when the jury does that, you feel that they don't have enough to ignore that information and it would be very difficult to have that verdict stand, right?
Yes.
to take them at their word? Or do we then look to their opinion that they had written and see all the other rhetoric about the victim in this case, and what a loss it is to the community? And can't we then assume that those letters may have played a part in the decision that they made concerning the defendant? Can that presumption be overcome by what they say in their opinion? Well, that's one sentence they use, but the other sentences sort of belie what they said. Not really. Bothered the Court of Appeals also, didn't it?
Well, it bothered the Court of Appeals so much that they found the three assignments of error on those issues well taken, didn't they? I mean, it's very clear what the Court of Appeals said. The troublesome in this case, the fact that even though the three-judge panel's opinion specifically disclaims reliance on the victim impact, it nonetheless expounds at length on the observation. Finally, they say we must concur with the appellant concerning these assignments of error. The internal conflict within the panel's decision dispels the presumption. I guess the reason we're even pressing you on it at all is, you know, that's already a finding by the Court of Appeals, and yet they've upheld the sentence of death. Why would you so doggedly hang to it when, do you need it to convince us? Well, but you specifically said the Court of Appeals is wrong. So if we find the Court of Appeals is right and that you're wrong, we should reverse. You understand that? You said the Court of Appeals is wrong. Supposing we read the opinion the same as the Court of Appeals reads it. That's different than you read it. That means you're wrong and the Court of Appeals is right according to us. Does that mean we reverse? Okay, exactly. Now, maybe we should...
Thank you.
What is needed in every capital case that reaches a mitigation stage is a careful and dispassionate review of the aggravating circumstances and mitigating factors, always mindful of the fact that capital punishment is an extraordinary and ultimate sanction. That is the essence of the capital punishment process in Ohio, and is what follows in this case to the letter. Are we to count that?
Here's why we should not be overturned on appeal. just want to
Could you explain that to me? What do you mean by these three judges did not know what they were doing.
I think that what the opinion reveals, what the opinion reveals to me, what the internal conflict was revealed by, what the internal conflict in the opinion revealed, what the repeated commentary in the opinion revealed, is a panel which, although disclaiming, taking the formal language of coldness and dispassionateness, in fact, about in fact control in making reaching this decision by the bias of praise. They have developed as a result, by the passions they've developed as a result of what they have experienced.
Let's boil it down to its essentials, because Justice Resnick is right going to that direction, and that's what I'd like to do too. Let's accept, just for purposes of argument, everything you say about the trial court's opinion and even the Court of Appeals opinion. Now we're here charged with the responsibility of independent review. So let's boil it down to its essentials. Here we have the aggravating circumstance of a cold-blooded murder, almost execution style. I mean, he backed the guy into the back room and put the gun to his head this close and killed him. One of the mitigating factors, other than age, in this case that we weigh against those, that. I mean, all this conversation is fine, but the statute gives us some pretty clear direction. Being a nice young man and artistic talent and all, I suspect you're bringing in under the mitigating factor under B7. Is that right? Okay. So we have the omnibus B7. We have the age factor that he's just over 20 at the time of the killing. What else is there to weigh against the nature and circumstances of how he even did this?
I don't have the other steps for a mitigating factor.
Okay.
Opinion.